now in session. Judge Flory, Judge Reyes, Judge Smith, the Honorable James E. Flory presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. And welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's September 25th, and we have six matters on our calendar today, the first four of which are oral cases. I'm sure counsel's familiar with our rules here. You'll each have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if they wish to exercise that. The podium's adjustable to your comfort, so feel free to move it up or down. There's a button on the front of it there. And if you would kindly identify yourselves for the record for us as you begin your arguments, that would be helpful. So with that, we'll call the first case on the calendar, A19-0242, Heinz versus Cambridge et al. Counsel can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Good morning. My name is Stephen Alanya. I represent the appellants, Cambridge Investment Research Advisors, Ms. Lisa Nesser, and her LLC. Although the respondents raised a number of alleged issues before the district court, the question that is properly before this court today is really a much simpler one, and that is whether the district court erred in denying my client's motion to compel arbitration on the grounds of a purported factual issue relating to an alleged forgery on one of three arbitration agreements. In so holding, the district court violated the inquiry required by the Federal Arbitration Act, and that's why we're respectfully asking this court to reverse the order of the district court and hold that the respondent has to arbitrate her claims as she agreed.
Counsel, do you agree that whether there was a valid formation of a contract containing an arbitration clause is a proper matter for court inquiry before we get to whether arbitration should be compelled?
Yes, Your Honor. The Federal Arbitration Act requires a court to consider whether a valid arbitration agreement exists. But what it does not require is for a district court to determine whether every single arbitration agreement at issue is valid and enforceable. And here, there is no dispute that the respondent makes no challenge whatsoever to one of the arbitration agreements that was before the district court. And that was the Trust Entity Information and Suitability Form, what my client abbreviates as the NAIF, but for ease of reference, I will refer to it as the Uncontested Agreement. And that's the agreement that begins at Appellant's Addendum at page 29.
And I understood that from the briefs, too. My question for you on that is, and I don't know if you want to address it now or later in your argument, depending on how you've structured your argument, but the claim is that when these investment accounts were transferred over, the respondent was sent a letter from Ms. Nesser that included some signature pages for the cap agreement and things like that. Now, so there's evidence in the record that respondent wasn't given the whole contract when she signed those signature pages. If that's the case, how can the NAIF agreement be enforceable against her to compel arbitration if in contracting she wasn't given all the information and specifically the application that is alleged to have been mistitled as an individual as opposed to a transfer on death account?
Well, Your Honor, I'll note that the respondent does not claim that she received less than the full agreement of the NAIF or the uncontested agreement. And that is an agreement that was unchallenged by the respondent at any point before the district court or in her brief before this court. But even assuming...
So it doesn't incorporate by reference the cap agreement or the application that she claims not to have gotten?
That's correct, Your
Honor. It stands alone.
That's correct, Your Honor. The uncontested agreement has a separate provision for arbitration, and that is at the appellant's addendum at pages 34 and 35. It does not incorporate any part of the agreement that the respondent alleges she did not receive. I will note in the agreement, the cap agreement, or what the respondent calls the advisory agreement in her briefs, that's the agreement that the respondent acknowledges that she signed, but claims that she did not receive all of the pages of that agreement. I'll note that her signature appears under the words stating that she read and understood the entirety of the agreement. But ultimately, that issue does not matter because of the standalone agreement and the uncontested agreement. And this is all that the Federal Arbitration Act requires in moving on to the second prong of the two-prong analysis that limited the district court's inquiry. That's why the district court's order is especially troubling, because...
Before we leave, and maybe you'll get to this, but as I understand the, I think the argument is, okay, even if there is a let's say the NAIF agreement is uncontested, it wasn't with these the agreement was not with these defendants. And are you arguing that's a question of the scope of the agreement? Like, who's the party to an agreement is a scope question? Can you explain to me, if that's your position, then walk me through why that belongs in arbitration, not at the district court.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. It is true that the issue of whether the arbitration agreement encompasses claims against Cambridge or Cambridge Investment Research Advisors, the advisory side of the firm, is a scope question. And that properly belongs under the second part of the two-prong FAA analysis.
Why is that a scope question? Do they have to be agents as written in on pages 34 and 35? I mean, is that what makes it a scope question, who the party is to the contract?
Well, the first prong of the FAA analysis doesn't inquire whether the dispute at issue is between the proper parties. It simply asks whether the person seeking to avoid arbitration signed a valid agreement to arbitrate. And there's no issue of that here. So it does fall within the second prong of the FAA analysis, which is whether the dispute falls within the scope of the agreement. Here, there are a few issues. First and foremost, the scope of the arbitration agreement at issue here is worded extremely broadly. It claims to encompass any claim or controversy which may arise between the respondent and Cambridge, including Cambridge's agents and including issues with Cambridge accounts. Here, the respondent admits in her amended complaint and in her appellate briefing that ultimately the facts at issue here involve her brokerage account and the way it was transferred from her old FINRA registered broker dealer to her new registered broker dealer. And in her amended complaint at page 62, she states that her claims arise out of the allegation that the defendants violated their duties, quote, in the course of selecting Cambridge as the new broker. So it was that transfer process from one brokerage firm to another brokerage firm of her brokerage account that makes this fall within the scope of the arbitration agreement. And that's because the FAA requires courts to give the broadest possible construction to the scope of arbitration agreements, especially when the language of the agreements, as here, are intentionally so broad.
So the agreement says this on page 34. In any event, it talks about on page 35 between us, and then it talks about Cambridge, et cetera, and then it says, you know, including any dispute involving the following and including blah, blah. So under your theory, the arbitrator could decide actually this falls outside the scope of the agreement.
It's
theoretically, right?
It's possible.
And that would be the appropriate, it's just who resolves it, not what they resolve.
That's
or
correct.
How they resolve it.
That's right, Your Honor. And that's a question for the arbitrator to decide, given the breadth of the scope of that arbitration provision at appellant's addendum at page 35.
So does the, Nesser? I'm sorry, I've forgotten the name.
Nesser,
thank you. Ms. Nesser, need to be an agent under your theory, determined to be an agent under this agreement for it to apply?
Your Honor, I think that's also a question for the arbitrator, but ultimately, because the way the FAA requires courts to conduct the analysis is it first looks to the language of the arbitration provision. When it sees broad language, like the language appearing at page 35, the standard becomes the respondent's burden to show that there's no possible interpretation of that language that could possibly encompass her claim. It's the positive assurance standard mandated by the Supreme Court. And this court has held that as long as things simply touch matters covered by the arbitration agreement, courts have to submit such scope questions to the arbitrators. Here, there's no question that given the respondent's allegations that her claims relate to the way her brokerage account transferred to a brokerage firm, This simply touches at least brokerage activity that's governed by FINRA and is therefore subject to FINRA's arbitration rules. At the very least, the FAA requires the FINRA arbitral forum to determine whether her claims in fact fall within the arbitration agreement. But courts have no power to make that determination for themselves, as the Minnesota Supreme Court has interpreted the FAA.
But courts do have the responsibility of making sure whether or not the agreement is, the allegation is what, that the agreement was fraudulently entered into, so that the agreement itself is void ab initio, not voidable. If it's voidable, then it's subject to FAA, but if it's void from the very beginning, that is something that the court can review.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that falls within that first prong of the FAA two-prong analysis. But here the respondent acknowledges that there's no void or validity issue with the uncontested agreement.
Right, but that's a separate issue, though. Yeah. Those two separate.
I'm sorry, but that gets to my original question that I'm still troubled by. There's evidence in the record, and I'm looking at what was listed as Exhibit A, I think, in one of your briefs or submissions or part of the record in any event. It's the CAP application. And that's the application that lists this account or mislabels the account as alleged as an individual account. There's evidence in the record that your clients never provided that application form to the respondent. So how can it be argued that there was a valid contract to begin with if they didn't have that crucial information when they signed the NAIF 2 years later? That's my question that I need clarification on.
A few points on that, Your Honor. First, the respondent admits that she did sign that agreement and that her signature appears under the words that she read and understood the entire agreement.
I think a fair reading of the record is she admits she signed the signature page. And Ms. Nesser's letter would suggest that she was only given the signature pages when she signed them. So how can we make the leap that she read the entire agreement when Ms. Nesser didn't give her the entire agreement to read in the first place? That's where I'm getting at. And I'm not saying I've decided that's true or not. What I'm saying is there a fact question as to the formation of the original contract? That's what I'm troubled by, quite frankly.
Understood, Your Honor, and there may be a fact question related to that agreement, but ultimately, given the inquiry required by the FAA, it has no bearing on the impact that this case still has to be submitted to arbitration because of the uncontested agreement.
Why is that if it goes to whether or not a valid contract was formed in the first place?
Because the uncontested agreement is a separate valid contract, and the goal of the FAA is to elevate arbitration agreements to the same standing as other contracts. We don't look in breach of contract actions as to whether every single contract between the parties is valid before we can award a plaintiff for a breach of a particular uncontested contract.
Right, but what we're talking about is what is the proper procedure here in terms of whether or not the court should evaluate it first before sending it off to FAA and send it off to arbitration. And it seems like, at least with one of the agreements, there is a fact question there as to whether or not a valid agreement was entered into and whether or not she actually knew about the rest of the agreement, or she just signed a signature page and that was it. It doesn't seem like there's enough to send it to arbitration based on that agreement.
That's fair, Your Honor, and I think that's true. Possibly based on that agreement standing alone, that might not be enough to submit it to arbitration. But that's not the case here, where there is a separate standalone uncontested
right,
agreement.
Right, but it seems to me that there are three agreements in play here, but only one that's been reviewed by the district court, and one that really is for us to review as to whether or not the district court erred in the interpretation of that contract. The other two, it seems to me that both parties agree that really needs to be remanded for that initial inquiry by the district court as well before making a determination that, yes, there's an invalid arbitration clause, and yes, that's how it should proceed.
That is not appellant's position, Your Honor. And in fact, because even if the district court had been allowed to continue down the course to allow the deposition related to one of the agreements and even go into fact-finding related to the advisory agreement, even if all of the respondent's allegations related to those agreements turned out to be true, we would still be left with the uncontested agreement with a valid arbitration clause that in no way is challenged by the respondent.
Which pages were alleged? Where are the pages in the addendum that were, with respect to the cap agreement, were not allegedly included? Do you know?
Your Honor, I know that the respondent admitted that her signature appears on appellant's addendum, page 16.
Mm-hmm.
She claims that a number of those other pages in that agreement she did not receive.
I mean, the reason I was asking, I just wanted to compare. Is there anything in pages 34, 35, which is what you describe as the uncontested agreement? Is there anything that the NAIF agreement includes that was you know what I'm saying? I guess, does it cover all the missing pages? That's my question. Does NAIF repeat what was in the missing pages relative to CAP?
Yes, I think I understand Your Honor's question, and that's true. If Your Honor looks to pages of the appellant's addendum 34 and 35 and compares it to the appellant's addendum at pages 20 and 21, you'll see the same arbitration provision. So ultimately, there's no issue, even if the CAP app, there's a factual issue. There's no challenge to the uncontested agreement, and that's all that the FAA requires in that first prong.
So it seems to me, if I may go over a little bit here, the question I think is, from your perspective, the question arises relative to your perspective, which is that the NAIF is uncontested and contains all the terms relative to agreement or arbitration. It doesn't matter that the CAP pages are irrelevant because the NAIF is comprehensive, right, as to arbitration. And she signed it, and there's no argument about forgery or no argument about missing pages relative to the NAIF. What the NAIF talks, the agreement in the NAIF says is a controversy which may arise between us. And then it goes on to describe those controversies. And I might be repeating myself, but I guess the question is the between us, not the nature of the controversies, but who is the us? And they're saying it's not you. I'm not suing you, the other party here. Why should is there any authority for who the party is to an arbitration agreement that falls within a scope of an arbitration agreement?
Yes, Your Honor, and I see my time has expired, if I may briefly
answer.
Thank you. Yes, Your Honor, the Eighth Circuit recognized in CD Partners LLC against Grizzle that who is a strict signatory to the arbitration agreement is a scope question, and non-signatories are still empowered to compel arbitration when there's a close enough relationship as there is here. Ultimately, we think it's the arbitrator's job to determine whether there's a close enough relationship to agree with, because it's the respondent's burden to show that there's no possible interpretation that could bring her dispute within the arbitration agreement.
All right. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
And counsel, the respondent, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Kirsten Hansen. With me at counsel table is Alex Herman. I represent the respondents, Jacqueline Heintz, individually and as personal representatives of the estate of Ada Colvin. There are, of course, two different, I think, lines of inquiry here. First, was there a valid contract? And second, if there is a valid contract, does it require arbitration in this case? So it's basically a jurisdictional issue. Who has jurisdiction to decide these questions? And I think it's unequivocal that this is the district court decision. The district court very prudently looked at this and said, you know what, there's some questions here as to whether or not these contracts even apply, if there was fraud, if there was anything else. Let's take a limited inquiry so I can resolve that issue as the district court. This isn't flinging the doors open. And I think that
one
was
one of the things we're obviously struggling with, though, counsel, is this two-page order of the district court is so incomplete in terms of what the court's analysis was. Maybe it doesn't matter if this is de novo review, but I think, you know, that's what we're struggling with here. And the district court doesn't address at all the third agreement, the NAIF agreement. So we don't know what the district court thought about that.
That is true, and perhaps that is a question for remand. But I still think, let's just take the NAIF agreement just to address it, which is signed, by the way, 3 years after I'm calling it the CAP agreement.
Yeah.
Or 2 years, I'm sorry, not three. So this is, as Council is trying to say this is a scope issue, and in some ways, this is a district court issue, too. Is there even a contract between these two parties? Now, I think it's important to note that it's Cambridge Investment Research Advisors, we call it CIRA, and then Cambridge, which is the brokerage. Those are two different companies. They have two different obligations. If you are an investment advisor, such as CIRA, and Ms. Nesser, when she was acting as the employee of CIRA, her fiduciary duty is to Ms. Colvin. That's her duty. She is an investment advisor. Her fiduciary duty is to her client. When she's wearing her broker hat as an employee of Cambridge, she now has a duty to the brokerage, not to a client. So these are literally two different parties, and Cambridge set that up this way. Cambridge is not a party to this litigation. They were dismissed.
So with respect to NAIF, you have an argument that Cambridge is not a party.
Correct.
Other than that, is there any validity challenge to the NAIF agreement?
I think that there is a validity challenge to the extent of, if you look at how the agreements go in scope, I think that if you look at the timing and the allegations of fraud and what kind of led up to this is what the district court was getting to, is how are we supposed to even know what's going on here? We need to have some inquiry as to whether or not this was a valid agreement.
What difference does it make if there's a forged signature in 2016? If there's no forged signature in 2018?
I think it makes a difference in the encompassing scope. Our claims in this case aren't the NAFI claims. They are the setup, the documents that we didn't have all of the documents for. So saying a document signed 2 years after somehow controls questions on an agreement that we didn't get, I think that's the question for the district court to decide. Is there...
So what's the validity challenge on what you call the NAFI? Is it that their pages are missing in one, or that there was a forged signature in the other?
Whether or not even applies.
Okay, so I'm just trying to isolate. That seems, who it applies to seems a different question from whether it's valid or not.
I understand the court's question. I think the validity question here that the district court was trying to address and that we wanted to have addressed is actually the underlying, the investment. The NAFI, though, or the NAFE, I think there is a question of validity. Yes, she signed it, but did she know what she was signing at the time? Did she have all the documents necessary to sign a valid agreement?
Is there some evidence she didn't have pages 34 and 35 in your addendum?
At the time of the NAFE agreement?
When she signed the NAFE, which includes the arbitration agreement at pages 34 and 35. Is there anything in the record to suggest that she did not have pages 34 or 35 when she signed the agreement that included 34 and 35? I didn't see anything in the record that she did not get pages 30. What, your addendum?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the exact timing. I honestly couldn't tell you as I stand here with any strict honesty. I think she did have the documents, but I don't want to...
Okay.
Misstate to the court or mislead the court in any way.
So then, to me, the question, your bigger issue is who is a signatory, or who's covered by that? This agreement doesn't apply to these defendants. Can you talk to me about the CD Partners case or what authority distinguished that? Or what authority do you have affirmatively that says who is a court decision, not an arbitrator's decision?
So I think the court should look at the Fleet Boston case, which is 264 Federal 3rd 770s out of the Eighth Circuit in 2001. And that's really what is talking about when cases need to be turned over to FINRA, or the precursor to FINRA, for arbitration decisions, and when the district court makes that decision. And I think that's the primary issue is, in this case, just to make very clear, FINRA, which is the arbitration body that this would be going to, simply doesn't cover investment advisors. It never has jurisdiction over it. So that would be a district court decision. If you have an agreement with a company that's not even part of this litigation, that doesn't force the portions in litigation into arbitration. It's the functional equivalent of saying, I have a I sue Bill, and Bill's brother, Fred, I have an agreement with Fred. And Bill says, well, I think it's Fred's fault. Now we're in arbitration. That you can't make this functional leap. Now, certainly, Cambridge or CIRA could go through FINRA arbitration on their own if they're claiming this is a Cambridge fault. But that's not our argument here. Our argument is not does not involve a brokerage claim. This never goes to FINRA, no matter what. This to determine whether or not arbitration even applies, you have to determine who the contract is between, and this does not fall under the FAA. That is a threshold issue for the district court to decide, and the district court was trying to decide it, and that's why we had the limited deposition. I think that's the most important thing is in some
ways... But
that
deposition doesn't seem like it goes to... Isn't that about the signature on the... however, NAFAD, whatever that other agreement is?
There's a lot of abbreviations here. I think that it goes to the contract formation. Yes, certainly. There's the fraud. There's the forgery. There's the did she have everything necessary to create a valid agreement. But then there's the sub-argument that now appellant is arguing here, which is doesn't matter what. You know, this just goes to FINRA for arbitration no matter what. And that's what I'm addressing with the claims here. Your Honors, I think the key issue here is look at what the court was trying to do. Perhaps the order was not a miracle of clarity. I think we all sometimes wish we wrote something a little bit different. But the district court was trying to make that basic decision. Is there a valid contract here? And that is for the district court to decide. And essentially what appellants are trying to do is strip away the ability of the district court to make a reasonable inquiry and a reasonable decision based on reasonable facts. And I think that is not taking away appellant's right to arbitration. What it is allowing the district court to fulfill its obligations to people who bring cases in front of it to make a reasonable determination. This isn't full-fledged discovery. This isn't some sort of, devil take the hindmost here. This is a reasonable discovery plan. And I think the district court made a good decision on that.
Did your client, or what does the record show? I guess you can answer it either way because I'll assume your answer is supported by the record. But I'm looking at the CAP agreement, page 6 of 18. It's listed on the bottom of the agreement. Starts out CAP application. And
correct.
That's kind of the crux of your argument here as to the mislabeling of the account.
Correct. It's not labeled as transfer on death.
Right. Now, these are the signature pages of this document is what Ms. Nesser sent your client to sign back in 2016.
Just the signature page, yes.
What?
Just the signature
right.
page.
The NAIF was signed 2 years later. So my question is, had your client been provided a copy of this page mislabeling the account, as you allege, at the time she signed the NAIF agreement, did she know that that account, or should she have known that that account was mislabeled as is alleged when she signed the NAIF agreement 2 years later?
No, she did not have. I believe that came out after we actually filed the complaint, that was documents we received after the original complaint was filed. So she didn't have an opportunity to look at what had happened before she signs the NAIF agreement. So, that's why in some ways this NAIF agreement, I consider it in some ways a red herring, and in other ways there is a question to its validity if she's signing agreements that she didn't have all the documentation before. And I think that's, again, to the district court's credit, he's trying to figure out what's going on that.
Right, but we don't even have anything in the record to indicate that that is what the district court is doing or considering. That's, one of the challenges that we face is it only addresses one agreement. It doesn't address the other agreements, much less the relationship between those agreements or what occurred.
And if that is this court's concern is whether or not this will be some sort of, which agreement is going to be addressed, I think that would be an issue for remand, asking the district court to clarify, what this deposition would be, going forward. But I don't think it is a matter of simply saying, district court, We didn't care for your order. You're overruled. It goes to arbitration.
No, I understand your position there, but I think it sounds like you're suggesting that we remand for consideration, affirm the district court on this particular contract, but remand for consideration of the other two contracts. But that, if I understand your position
correctly. That would be, yes, okay. I think that would be fair.
But isn't this an issue of law for us in terms of what the contracts actually mean and whether or not it is actually a binding arbitration, a valid binding arbitration clause in the other two agreements? And if that's the case, why can't we just settle that issue right here?
Because I don't think the court has all the information, which was also the district court's problem. Yeah, we have issues of contract formation here. We have issues of contract validity, which is why the district court itself couldn't make a decision about contract validity, which is, I would agree with you, Your Honor, that this is a question of law. But this is the kind of the somewhat narrow issue that's before this court is whether or not the district court had the option or the obligation to order somewhat limited discovery to answer that question, to be able to make that question of law decision.
What information is needed on the NAIF agreement to determine the NAIF agreement's validity?
I think that for the NAIF agreement, I think it is the actions going up to it and what she had at the time the NAIF agreement was signed. I disagree with appellant's position that this is a standalone agreement that somehow doesn't encompass a overall relationship.
And why is that? What can you point to in a NAIF agreement that incorporates by reference an earlier agreement?
I think actually, Your Honor, it's not in the contract. It's a fiduciary duty type argument that it was perhaps obtained via fraud or something to that effect, or that she simply didn't have all the information. This is, again,
I'm struggling with what she's lacking in 2018 when she signs a NAIF agreement. When a NAIF agreement has an arbitration paragraph 17 that doesn't look appreciably different from the pages that she claims not to have gotten in 2016.
She lacked the agreement where she found, she lacked the agreement with the failed transfer on death information.
So the mistake.
Yes.
Agreement.
Correct.
That's what she
never
so
had.
She didn't know what had gone wrong when she agreed to arbitrate a dispute.
Yes, and in fact, it's our contention that that was affirmatively concealed from her.
And how does not knowing about a claim render an agreement to arbitrate invalid?
You have to understand, I'm going back to law school, it's two ships perilous. When you enter into a contract, you have to understand both parties have to be in the same agreement. And an agreement to arbitrate, which strips away your rights to pursue a claim in district court, is, while it's broad, it is not unlimited, and you have to go in knowing and understanding what you are signing. So I think, again, I understand the court's concern that here's the standalone arbitration agreement, but I think that, particularly in this case, you need to look at all of the facts and all of the agreements together.
Can I, and with respect to the argument about acting as an agent for Sierra versus Cambridge, is your argument that Ms. Nesser was acting as an agent for Sierra at the time the document that I don't have the addendum, but with the mistake was made?
That is exactly what we are arguing, okay. Your Honor, that she was not acting, and in fact, she could not be acting as a broker because that's not what the broker does. It's a financial advisory thing to complete that form, this application. That is the application that applies for a relationship with Cambridge. So she literally couldn't be acting as a broker for Cambridge when she completed that application. I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish.
May it please the court, a few points on rebuttal. This court just asked respondent's counsel what more the respondent needed to recognize the validity of the NAIF agreement. And respondent's answer, which is the first time respondent has contended this, is that she needed to know what she was signing. A few points here. First of all, the FAA requires that signed arbitration agreements carry a burden or carry a presumption of validity and that they are binding and enforceable, as this court recognized in Kilcher v. Dale in 2010. In addition to that, it's therefore respondent's burden to show that that presumption of validity does not apply. Now, the respondent says that it should not apply because the respondent needed to know what she was signing. But general contract principles recognized by not only Minnesota, but also the state of Iowa, the choice of law chosen by the parties in the arbitration agreement, recognize that when a party signs a contract, she cannot later claim ignorance of the contents of those contracts.
Right, but what we're talking about here is not signing a contract, but signing a page of a contract, a page of a document. And I think there's been enough fact questions raised here as to whether or not she even had the rest of the agreement and if she knew about the rest of the agreement. So that seems to be a question of whether or not the formation of that contract is valid that the district court should at least take a look at to make that determination before sending it off to arbitration.
Not in the NAIF agreement, Your Honor. The respondent had all of the pages of that agreement, and she concedes that as much. She never contested in the district court that she did not have all of the pages of the standalone NAIF agreement. And there was a point about, well, she didn't know that there was a dispute at that point. But that's what pre-dispute arbitration agreements are. They're an agreement to arbitrate any disputes that may arise. It doesn't matter whether she did or did not know about the particular mistitling allegation that she now asserted in the district court. And that's why there really can be no issue on that first prong required by the Federal Arbitration Act. There is a valid agreement to arbitrate here, and that's the standalone NAIF agreement, which is uncontested.
So can you speak to the argument that, okay, but that's not an agreement with these parties. It needs to be these parties. It could not be because Ms. Nesser was not. What difference does an agreement with Cambridge make when the dispute centers around Ms. Nesser's actions, not as a Cambridge agent, employee, et cetera?
Because, Your Honor, it's only the respondents say so that it's not a dispute with Cambridge, the brokerage side. A respondent can't avoid an arbitration agreement by simply labeling her claims in a way that would stand outside the scope of the arbitration agreement. Because as the Eighth Circuit held in Parm against Bluestem Brands in 2008, the court must look beyond the parties' labels that they attach to their claims and look at the underlying allegations. Here, the underlying allegations all stem from the transfer of a brokerage account from a former broker-dealer to a new broker-dealer. All of those entities are governed by FINRA, and we argue all of those fall within the scope of FINRA arbitration, but ultimately we would ask that the arbitrator decide that question.
So you would argue that even if she was acting as an agent of CIRA, not of Cambridge, that it would still fall within the scope?
I'm saying that a FINRA arbitrator could find, if she was acting as an advisory agent, that it might fall outside the scope. But it's the arbitrator that has to make that determination. The district court has no power to under the Federal Arbitration Act because of the broad scope of the arbitration agreement and, as a separate matter, because the arbitration agreement incorporates FINRA rules. As the respondent acknowledged, the arbitration agreement incorporates FINRA rules, and the Eighth Circuit has held that this amounts to a clear and unmistakable evidence of intent to submit threshold questions of arbitrability to the arbitrator.
What case is that?
That was in FSC Securities Corp. against Friel in 1994. The Eighth Circuit reaffirmed that rule in Fallow against High Tech Institute in 2009. And I'll note that the Iowa Supreme Court follows the same rule in Smith Barney, Inc. against Keeney. All of these show, and this court held in Kilcher against Dale, that incorporation of FINRA rules, including the jurisdictional rule that allows FINRA arbitrators to decide the scope of FINRA rules, compelled arbitration when a contract incorporated the rules of FINRA. All of these are separate bases for the broad arbitration agreement provision at issue in the uncontested agreement that divests the district court of the ability to determine whether Ms. Hines' claims in fact fall within the scope. We're simply asking that this court enforce the provisions of the Federal Arbitration Act and hold that Ms. Hines has to submit her claims to an arbitrator. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And the matter's been extensively briefed. We appreciate your arguments here today. The court will take the matter under advisement. We'll issue a decision on the matter within 90 days. Thank you.